From UA Little Rock Public Radio, this is The Art Scene. I'm Daniel Breen, in for Ann Nicholson. Today, we move past the tutus and tights and take a look at Ballet Arkansas's frightfully spooky season-opening show. The city's professional dance company kicks off its 41st season with a world premiere multimedia interpretation of Washington Irving's infamous legend of Sleepy Hollow. The ballet's associate artistic director, Catherine Fothergill, and executive and artistic director, Michael Fothergill, fill us in on the details. Then we pause to remember literary critic Harold Bloom, who died this week at the age of 89. Later on in the show, we'll hear an excerpt from Bloom's 2001 conversation with The Art Scene's Ann Nicholson. But now, here's Catherine Fothergill. It seems that this ballet is very unique in that it's a multimedia experience. Is that something that's been used before in ballet or just in dance in general, a video projection along with 360-degree sound?
I don't know about the 360 sound, but I do know, you know, there are companies in the States that use a projector to project more stock images. However, what's unique about our world premiere, and because we have the honor of working with Cranford Co., who's also a neighbor, is that we've been able to take our dancers to local, you know, Arkansas-based locations, Historic Arkansas Museum, Alsop Park, and we've filmed them running through the woods and dancing and interacting. And those photos and videos will be projected on the backdrop. So it's not only a projection of, you know, an image, but while the dancers are, you know, preparing for a scene, those videos will set the stage or they will happen simultaneously. So this world premiere is unique in that that has not necessarily been done before.
So as you mentioned, it is a world premiere. I was just wondering what the... I guess, what was the genesis for the project? Why was the legend of Sleepy Hollow chosen as the theme for a ballet?
Great question. Well, when Michael and I joined, we wanted to expand the programming and introduce more story ballets, introduce works that haven't been seen here in Arkansas before. And a part of that initiative, last year, we kicked off our season with Dracula, and the community really got behind this Halloween-based and kind of dark series that we started in October. So this year we followed that up by, you know, building something brand new, sticking with the more eerie than gory for the production. It is based off of Washington Irving's classic tale. But because there is some ambiguity in that storyline, Michael has taken that ambiguity and added in a lot of character development and relationships and love triangles, and as well as keeping that mystery about the Headless Horseman throughout the town. So it's something that we felt the community really enjoyed, and we wanted to expand on that. And this is the start to our 2019-20 season, and I think it's a really good way to kick off being a more immersive and interactive experience for the people that are coming into the theater.
In ballet, which is so different than what a regular stage play of Sleepy Hollow would be, I guess, what is the creative process like when you mentioned, you know, there's that ambiguity where you're working with the script and looking to sort of fill things in and develop characters? I guess, how is that different when you're considering that all of these characters will have to be dancing as well?
It's built into the choreography. A large part of, you know, the dancing is every step has a meaning. So as we coach the dancers in the studio, we ask them, you know, every step that they take, what is your motivation? Why are you turning that direction and doing this pirouette? You know, because in dance, that step, you know, doesn't necessarily need a meaning, but it can tell a story in the way that the dancer steps into the step, in the way that they're looking, in the way that they, you know. So it is, with a story ballet, much more in-depth with the rehearsal process and making sure that the dancer's not only comfortable with the material, you know, getting the dancing in their body, but they're also thinking from the very beginning of the story to the end and how their character interacts with other people in the town, the way that they carry themselves, and how they build their emotions so that the audience can, you know, feel that with them as well. So maybe a little bit more similar to a script where we think through, you know, sentences when they're doing their pantomime. We talk to them about, okay, what are you saying to this person, you know, and actually saying a sentence in your head as you do the gestures so that it is real to them as well as for them trying to be that character as they're doing their leaps and turns across the stage.
Right. And I can imagine that, you know, just based on the pictures that I've seen, the set and the costumes and everything sort of helps them to get into that character. I was just wondering about what was your take on this? Because, you know, when you think of Sleepy Hollow, you think of what, I mean, 18th century New York or something. But or as you mentioned earlier, you sort of modernized it a bit. I was just wondering what that process was like.
So the ballet is considered neoclassical. That means that the choreography is a departure from our very traditional classical ballet, such as the Nutcracker. And we initially, you know, going into this process, really wanted it to have a little bit more of an abstract and modern feel. So we've taken every aspect and tried to find ways to blend both that time period and, you know, just the basics of the story with what is both current here in Arkansas and what's more current in our society. So, for example, with our sets, we decided not to build complete filled-in realistic sets, but we worked with more of a frame. And you can see through the frame and the way that the dancers interact with the set piece that they can tell that that's a window, or they can see that, you know, if we filled it in, it would be a house. And the benefit of that is with the choreography, then you're able to see, you know, the dancers inside the house as well as Brahm listening on the outside of the house to what's happening inside. And you're able to see their dancing as well as, you know, have a little bit more of an abstract staging. Other examples, there are costumes. We have both rented costumes and built costumes for this production, which is fairly typical within a ballet. And we've taken, you know, some jackets and things that are more of that time period, and we've blended that with tights and ballet boots, which is a very modern look. So through costumes, sets, through the choreography as well, all of those things, and of course, with the projections being local sites here in Arkansas, I think that that is a way to also draw in an audience that is living in the world that we are today.
It looks from the picture that I have, at least, that there is an actual horse in there for the Tale of the Headless Horseman. I was just wondering if if that was if that presented any unique challenges or anything like that, working with a horse.
The horse will not appear at the Park Theater. However, yes, we were able to use a horse for our initial photo shoot. It took some planning to determine how we wanted to portray the Headless Horseman, considering the challenges. So our costume designer has built a really fantastic costume where it does look like our gentleman is headless, and he is dancing with that barrier across his face, so his visibility is definitely not as high as he would like for those scenes. But we are working with, you know, using that projection to show, you know, the setting and running through the forest, as well as having the character be dressed. It looks very realistic, and the horse will unfortunately not appear on stage with us.
We are always looking for programming that we feel will appeal to a broader audience, particularly those that maybe have not been exposed to a Ballet Arkansas performance and aren't sure what to expect at a Ballet Arkansas performance. And so, of course, around Halloween time, everyone is eager to try new things. They're excited about exposing themselves to Halloween-y activities. And so we were thinking about storylines in the fall. And after last year's success with Dracula, we thought, well, we would do another Halloween-themed performance. And this time we were going to focus on something that had a little bit more depth and a little bit more characterization. So Sleepy Hollow was the first choice, and very good choice at that, I think.
What was the significance of Sleepy Hollow, I guess, to you personally? Was that a story that you remember reading as a young kid and sort of being terrified by?
Well, actually, yes. I remember reading the book when I was younger in school. And oftentimes with reading assignments, you know, you either take to the story or you don't. And this is one of those that I liked the ambiguity about it. And as an adult and also as a choreographer, I also like the ambiguity because there's a lot of mystery that is not specified in the storyline about the town, about the inner workings of the characters. We're not necessarily entirely sure how the story ends and what happens after Ichabod goes missing. So there's a lot of narrative that leaves room for choreographic choices, which I was particularly appealed by.
And that seems kind of like a thing that's integral to the structure of the story that maybe you don't want to give away too much about it. You want to sort of enshrine this mystery into it. How was that? Like you said, how do you express ambiguity through choreography, I guess?
Well, the interesting thing about this version of Sleepy Hollow in particular is that it is multimedia based in the sense that we have shot live footage of our dancers in Alsop Park or at the Historic Arkansas Museum, which is used as the backdrop for the ballet. And so we see some things in the video which are alluded to in the choreography, and that helps to bring the experience full circle for the audience member. As well, there's narrative that's projected on the screen, so if audience members are wondering how to interpret certain portions of the ballet or what the latitudes of interpretation are, they've got a little bit of boundary up there. In terms of choreographic choices directly, though, I like the fact that throughout the book, Sleepy Hollow, we're not entirely sure who the Headless Horseman is. And so what I've done, given the fact there's some ambiguity in that original narrative, is that I've added additional characters into the ballet, which we at all, or all at one point, can suspect each one of them. So we never really know which one of the male characters is guilty. There are certainly motives and bias for each one of them, but it leaves a little bit of freedom to interpret as the audience member views the ballet.
To just talk about the choreography process a little bit, was this essentially a fresh build? I guess a fresh build, you would call it. Was this? Did you have to completely just base this off of the source material and write your own ballet?
Well, what I did was over the course of last summer, I reread a number of times the original story, and I wanted to determine what I felt were plot holes and choreographic opportunities. Things that I could explore that weren't touched on to a great degree, or things that perhaps I wanted more elaboration on. And then I rewrote the story to include additional townsfolk so that I could draw more conclusions and build a larger understanding of what actually happens in the town of Sleepy Hollow. And so I started to emphasize those dynamics over the course of the first 2 weeks in the studio when I was building the choreography. It's all world premiere choreography, so it's built from scratch. And a lot of the characterizations were fairly well in my mind prior to walking into the studio with the dancers the first time. However, as the rehearsal process unfolded, I'd like to see what their interpretations are, knowing that some of these characters are new and they're not necessarily obliged to be acted one way or another. And of course, then with the ambiguity that exists in the framework of the original storyline, there's also a little bit of flexibility to adapt the presentation as well. So I would say I went into the rehearsal process at the start of the season, understanding the big bullet points that I wanted to achieve out of the ballet. And then over the course of the 6-week rehearsal period, in collaboration with the dancers, we fine-tuned some of the characterizations of individual characters and their interactions on stage.
As you mentioned, ambiguity was one thing that you wanted to get across, but also, you know, it's a scary story, so it must sort of be, at least I would think it would be sort of difficult to balance the very, you know, the beautiful aspect of choreography of dance with the sort of more macabre elements that you want to get across.
First and foremost, the thing to note about the choreography is that it is what we would call to be neoclassical. There are some classical elements that are codified steps that anybody that has an understanding of ballet will recognize, but a lot of the movement itself is contemporary. And so that gives us more ability, or flexibility, I should say, to adapt the actual steps to fit whatever sort of feeling we want to have on stage without being restricted by specific positions or stereotypes. So I would say the choreography does a very good job bringing the eeriness out, in the sense that there are some really beautiful points in the music that balance that eeriness. So we're not going to be sitting watching an hour and a half of misery. It's something where there's some really beautiful moments. There's a lot of love in Sleepy Hollow. There's a lot of connection between characters. There's a lot of desperation. There's also a lot of fear and fright and excitement in certain characters as well. So the goal ultimately was to try to show multiple facets of the same character. So for example, our town magistrate, the most powerful man in town, Baltus Van Tassel, we see him as a father. We see him caring for his daughter. We also see him lecturing his daughter. We also see him in a number of different triangles of hate with different characters on stage, and we also suspect him of being the headless horseman. So you really get to see the full spectrum of emotion from each one of the characters, and that is definitely echoed in the choreographic sentiment as well.
The choreography that you did for this show sort of avoids stereotyping, as you put it. I think, yeah, certainly this story would not fall into the, I guess, traditional ballet stereotype. I just wonder if you feel sort of drawn to that type of narrative as, you know, as the director of a ballet, do you sort of gravitate towards things that people might not expect to actually be a ballet?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're always trying to be innovative and to enhance the audience experience. And the question we always ask ourselves is, if we knew nothing about ballet, would we be appealed by this? And the programming that you'll see from a lot of ballet companies tends to be balanced between narrative that audience members will recognize or their children will recognize. So for example, this year we've got Cinderella on the bill. That's something that's really good for the company to do. It's got a lot of challenging choreography. It's very funny, so adults will enjoy it. But it's also something that children grow up knowing and falling in love with that story. On the other hand, we don't want people to think of ballet as tutus and tights. And oftentimes, a lot of the programming that we seek to achieve is what I find based upon curiosity. We want people to look at our programming and wonder what they're going to experience. And ultimately, I think that curiosity is what compels them to come to the theater in many cases, especially with those younger audience members or those that are not necessarily repeat attendees at Ballet Arkansas performances.
That was Michael Fothergill, Executive and Artistic Director of Ballet Arkansas, and Catherine Fothergill, the ballet's Associate Artistic Director, talking about the ballet's rendition of Sleepy Hollow, which runs at the UA Pulaski Tech Charts Theater from October 18th through 20th. Now, we take a look back at literary critic Harold Bloom's conversation with Art Scenes and Nicholson in 2001. Bloom died this week at age 89.
Human relationships are fragile, and sometimes we should and need to turn to books for consolation and for the companionship that we otherwise may not find. But that's, of course, only a small part of why I think we should read.
I go back probably to the same generation as yourself in terms of the education that I had. Elocution was major subject when you had to learn by heart.
That is something that I have tried to revive with the best of my students here at Yale. I do not let them get through a semester without asking them, after we have thoroughly discussed a poem by Tennyson or by Wallace Stevens or by Hart Crane or a sonnet by Shakespeare, to read it out loud to themselves or to others again and again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When it's not a question of learning by rote or reading by rote, but of really understanding and deeply feeling what it is that one has read, but also then possess it by memory and let it possess you, and, you know, come in and let us indeed recite it to one another. And part of reading well, on both the how and the why of it, is indeed learning to speak well, learning to recite the poem for its full expressive values. It's why I think reading out loud, whether to oneself or others, whether one is reading Dickens or Shakespeare, is so invaluable an experience.
Well, it expands not only the mind but the vocabulary, and you can begin to use different words to express your own thoughts in a way that you hope clarify ideas.
Yes, no, of course. The expansion of vocabulary is part of the question of expanding the mind, though it's no sure or certain route to expanding one's intellect or one's creativity. But I never let myself forget that William Shakespeare used the largest single vocabulary of any author in human history, of any language of which we have record. Shakespeare used rather more than 21,000 words, 1,800 of which he had coined for himself, and many of which have, of course, become standard in the language. And what fascinates me even more, Anne, is that, you know, forgetting expletives and connectives, ands and buts and so on, but of real words, half of those 21,000 words that Shakespeare uses, he uses only once, as though having found the perfect context for it.
I wonder and worry about what happens to books in the coming years, because a book in which one reads something that leads to other thoughts, you've also got the touch, the feel of the book, the other senses that are brought, the smell.
I wrote a piece on that for the New York Times style section not so long ago, because the Packard people, they had sent me, for the purpose of this, a handheld computer on which they had downloaded a rather dubious piece of fiction by Michael Crichton, and they wanted me to have the experience of what it was like reading off a kind of e-book. I found it a most dreadful experience. I know that e-books are here and that more of them are coming, and there are many enthusiasts who say that we will do away with printed books entirely. I don't believe it for a moment, Anne.
I couldn't bear to think that.
I don't think it will happen, and I like to tell the following joke, as it were, which I find very clarifying. Think how it would be if we had had e-books all through these centuries, as we have had printed books since Gutenberg. And how would it be now if suddenly they had come up with this wonderful new invention of the bound and printed book? How delighted we would be. We would say, look, it doesn't have to be plugged in. You don't have to worry about malfunction. You just have to turn the page. It is very compact indeed. You can put it away in your briefcase or tuck it under your arm and take it out into the woods. What a great invention the printed book is.
And you can be quiet with it. You don't have that insidious beetle clicking, that restless tapping of the keys.
You should indeed read it, unless you're reading aloud to another human being for whom in some way you care. You should indeed be free to either read it silently or read it out loud to yourself, either in a room where you find yourself by yourself or in solitude outdoors.
And the other thing, of course, that stays in one's mind as one looks back is the incredible comfort of a book lined room, the wall that has a color and depth, and where you can go for old friends, knowing exactly where they are with the message that you're looking for.
It would be very difficult.
Something that I get so worried about in the current generations is the obliteration of imagination, the electronic age is doing.
The young grow up now visually overstimulated. There are screens. There is, of course, the television screen, the motion picture screen, but most important, and I think
most dangerous.
Yeah, you know, from the view of literature, what is most dangerous, or is a double-edged kind of phenomenon, is the computer screen, particularly when you reach the phenomenon of the World Wide Web. The Internet is a great gray ocean in which a highly educated or aware person wandering around and knowing what she or he is really looking for will certainly find it, and that, of course, is an immense asset. But if you go into it without any capacity to differentiate between one work and another, if you go into it inadequately educated and inadequately aware of language and its powers and its difficulties, then indeed I believe it becomes an ocean in which too many drown.
Looking at the choices you have, so many of them were my favorites. Patrick Spens, you spell it differently.
With all of the popular ballads, there are many variant versions. They come out of a period reaching from the high medieval to the 17th century, in which people vary the spelling of their name all the time. I mean, Shakespeare spelled his name 5 or 6 different ways quite indifferently.
Yeah.
And Ben Jonson sometimes put the H in the Jonson and sometimes kept it off, in the same way with the title of Sir Patrick Spens.
Have you read a story by Kipling called Wireless?
Yes.
In which he comments on the frisson, the sort of shiver of recognition when a line of poetry does something more than just paint a picture.
Yes, well, it's what Miss Emily Dickinson was talking about when she said that if she was reading a poem and she suddenly felt all the hairs stand up on the back of her head, then she felt it really was poetry. That's I suppose, why I began the poetry section with that lyric that always haunts me, "Houseman, into my heart, air that kills from yon far country blows. What are those blue remembered hills? What farms, what spires are those? That is the land of lost content. I see it shining plain, the happy highways where I went and cannot go again." Those eight lines, those few words, go right through me. Houseman has the gift that William Blake has in even greater measure to shiver you with just a few lines, like Blake's The Sick Rose, for instance. "O Rose, thou art sick, the invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy." The ability to pack it in to, you know, 30 words or so like that is quite astonishing.
Yes, Keats has it in that marvelous sonnet, "When I have fears that I may cease to be."
Yes.
It's something that you can never avoid reacting to when a poem or a phrase in a book or a chapter or a story suddenly brings in some kind of intimation of mortality that you're not quite ready for.
There is what I so emphasized in that book you were kind enough to read, Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, the extraordinary speech of Vincentio, the Duke, when he is disguised as the false friar in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, the speech that so afflicted Dr. Johnson, who wrote marvelously about it, and then lingered in the ears of T.S. Eliot, since he uses it as the epigraph for his poem Gerontion, in the midst of that great speech, which begins, "Be absolute for death. Either death or life shall thereby seem thee sweeter." Suddenly, in the midst of it, you get extraordinary cognitive music. "Thou hast nor youth nor age, but as it were an after-dinner sleep, dreaming on both."
And in a play that isn't done very often.
Measure for Measure. It's a difficult play.
Getting back to some of your aspects of how to read and the use of irony.
In the simplest and broadest sense, which is when the poet or someone in a story or a novel, or most of all perhaps on the Shakespearean stage, says one thing but rather clearly means another, sometimes indeed the very opposite by implication. To lose that sense of irony is, I think, to lose the capacity to read great and serious literature. And of course, I speak about the recovery of irony as one of the major principles of reading, because I think we are in great danger of losing it now.
That was Harold Bloom, author and literary critic who died earlier this week at age 89. Bloom spoke with The Art Scene's Ann Nicholson in 2001.
And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.